We have an interesting subject this morning, and I realize that for a great many folks, this is a sensitive area. But I think in fairness to all concerned, we must face into some of the phenomena of our times. You will probably remember, some of you at least, that following World War I, there was a tremendous emphasis upon spiritualism. A number of very brilliant leaders of public thought, men of the caliber of Sir Oliver Lodge, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Professor Hyslop, became concerned with survival, the continuance of consciousness after death. Obviously, the cause of this tremendous emphasis was the tragedy of the war itself. Millions of young people died in that war. Their parents, their friends, even their children became deeply involved in the hope of the survival of consciousness. This resulted in extensive research in psychic phenomena, and to a measure at least, this research is continuing to the present time. But at the moment, the situation seems to be somewhat different. The average person in this country, at least, has not had the experience of the parents of World War I in Europe. They have a different point of view, and modern psychology, psychic phenomena, appear to be focused in a different direction. And in the last year or two particularly, I have been almost inundated with requests to explain psychic occurrences in the lives of people. I get letters from all over this country and Europe, and people constantly want to know what some psychic experience they have had means. Sometimes they tell me the experience. Sometimes they think I ought to know it already. But after having read the description, if they have one, we are all more or less nonplussed. There seems to be no general, natural, significant, practical way of explaining a great part of this outburst of psychic pressure that is in the atmosphere at the present moment. You pick up some journals and publications, and you think of Egypt, and you remember the thousands of little charms and talismans and figures that were worn around the necks of the Egyptians and buried with them. In the paper, we find that today similar charms and talismans and amulets are being offered seriously on the grounds that they have psychic influence. So over a period of 4,000 years, the same phenomena continues. This is something we have to give a little thought to. I've looked around, and I'm not interested in exposing or downgrading the psychic seeking of the human being. Far from it. I feel quite convinced that there are some perfectly honorable and perfectly practical and reliable consequences in some cases. But the true mystical experience is comparatively rare. And much of the material that comes in almost every day for consideration simply cannot represent a valid approach to the problems involved. I think one of the most interesting problems that we have to consider is the source of this tremendous torrent of psychism that is now moving in on us. And looking around, it seems to me that perhaps Buddhist philosophy comes the nearest of any philosophical structure that could have a bearing on the subject. Buddha was the one who first psychologically emphasized the importance that that which comes out of the individual in most cases is something that went into him from his material environment. In other words, the human being receives through the sensory perceptions certain impressions. These impressions, coordinated by the mental unifier, after a time, these impressions, interpreted, digested, and unified, come out again through the individual, and he attributes them to some source within himself. Let us see if we can make this point a little clearer. Wherever we have social insecurity, we have pressure upon the psychic life. When things run easily and comparatively smoothly, and the individual is relatively secure, his mind does not run to this type of thinking. But when he is variously bewildered, when he does not know what to do next, when he does not know how to evaluate the conditions of his own life, he then rushes to someone else for help. Now, psychology, from a scholastic standpoint, has had much to do with trying to rationalize the problems of society. But there are other problems which psychology cannot handle because of its limited perspective. These are problems of the individual's personal interior life, where he is uncertain as to his own conduct, where he is confused. This confusion becomes part of his subconscious. This remains very much like Pandora's box with the lid down until the individual does something to lift the lid. One of the things he may do to try to lift the lid is to practice some kind of meditational disciplines. He may try to unfold his own consciousness in an effort to reach into himself for greater security. Now, how he is going to do this is again a problem. I suppose that there are 50 or 100 different recommended ways to unfold inner consciousness. Most of these ways differ in one respect or another. The individual reaching out for some way of cultivating his inner faculties is very likely to practice some type of metaphysical discipline, concentration, meditation. He is apt to try almost any type of method of concentrating attention upon the unfoldment of internal factors. This, in many instances, arises in persons that are not at all equipped to handle this type of situation. They firmly believe, in fact, in some cases, they are taught to believe, that all they have to do is to practice some meditational discipline and the inner life will move out through them. Or, perhaps, under certain conditions, through these types of disciplines, they will be brought into contact with superior beings, hierarchies or orders of life, which will enable them to get the solutions they seek to the problems they face. Now, this situation has resulted in a series of very strange circumstances, which I think are probably best approached through the Buddhistic philosophy. We have to have some kind of a framework for this. We have to rationalize it or organize it before we can examine it. If we wish to assume that the individual, over the course of years, has become involved in a load of psychic pressures within himself, if we realize that all kinds of things that happened to him on the material plane of life, have left scar tissue, have built various pressures into his subconscious personality. There is the person who arose in a divided home, who never had proper parental relationships. There is another who came from a bigoted or irresponsible family and had no proper encouragement for the development of normal faculties. We have individuals who had bad marriages and were unable to cope with the family responsibility problems. Also, we have some graduates from the drug culture. We have individuals that 10 or 12 years ago were tied into the drug subculture. Many of them have worked out of it and are no longer involved in it. But the record of it, the pressures of it, the consequences of it are still in themselves. We also find others who are financially insecure. Jobs are hard to keep. The individual has not had sufficient training to feel secure in his employment. He may have extravagant tastes which he is unable to gratify. He may be picked up in the inflation, or he may be trying to buy a home and cannot get the necessary loans to take care of the deal. He may also have health problems. Many people are finding tremendous nervous ailments developing from tension, stress, frustration, and self-pity. All of these pressures retire into the individual. And under normal conditions, perhaps they will remain there for his entire lifetime. If he is a materialist and has no belief in any mystical or metaphysical factors in daily living, then he will simply ignore this and go on being sorry for himself, but rationalize it in terms of his external circumstances. If, however, he is more religiously inclined, if he is looking for some inner understanding of the phenomenon that he is faced by, then he begins to attempt to develop some form of internal spiritual security. He takes the attitude that he must, from within himself, release values which will take care of him. He is taught this. Many groups are advertising it. Many individuals are working with each other in these problems, the idea being to break through the outer crust of fear and anxiety and find a quiet, serene inner life behind the problems of daily existence. But here is where the Buddhist philosophy steps in. It points out that when you open the door between the objective and the subjective, you open that door into a world with which you have very little experience. You also take a very serious chance that when this door is opened, the flood of your own inner psychic stress is going to pour out into the objective life. Instead of being redeemed and at peace, you are going to be in greater confusion than you were before. This confusion, however, is not always easily rationalized. It is not something in which the actual incidents of your previous physical experiences will be revealed to you. You will not be able to find always or very often that some pressure in your psychic life can be immediately traced to a particular incident in your environment. In many cases, it becomes a kind of vague form of reaction. This reaction most always takes the form of symbolism. And symbolism is a very difficult thing to work with. If the pressures within yourselves come out into manifestation through symbols rather than through incidents, then you have the same type of problem that is involved in dream symbolism. The individual awake can release a dream underworld from within himself. And this presenting itself in all kinds of forms and all types of symbols, emblems, figures, and devices can present a very serious problem. Now, one of the more simple but definite examples of this is the study of dispositional and character attitudes. The average person wants to have a sphere of influence. He wants some sense of importance. He wants to have leadership of some kind in something. He is very desirous of preparing some type of background to become a significant person. Now, this is a situation that can very often become deeply involved in psychic phenomena. The individual, for example, is not content with his job. He feels that he could do something bigger and better. And most people feel this, to a measure at least, that they are restricted and limited by circumstances and that their true worth is not appreciated. This can appear in business, in family, in relationships of parents and children. But many persons have a distinct feeling that they should be doing more than they are doing in the sense of gaining a distinction of some kind. Now, there are two ways of approaching this particular problem. Those who are very practical in their thinking and are not too heavily loaded psychically with pressures decide, well, there's a great future for computerization, therefore I'm going to take a course in it. I'm going to study it. I'm going to find ways of advancing my career. Other people, however, with a little different type of mind and maybe not quite as much true basic ambition, would like to gain this superior relationship with life without any serious effort on their own part. So they philosophize along the idea that they have a right to be anything they want to be without really earning this advancement. They want to get it in some other way. So some try to get it through prayer, others through concentration and meditation, and still others through contact with mystics and psychics who are going to be able to give them some kind of a philosophy of personal superiority. We have this all the time. Most of the people who are having psychic disturbances at the present time have in some way involved themselves in the social problems of the hour and feel that they have been curiously and wonderfully appointed to become one of the great solving factors in human problems, that they are the ones who are going to be the future leaders of a spiritualized world. Well, we have a great many of these folks come along, and I have watched their progress over probably, well, over half a century now. And I have not yet found any instance in which a psychic promise that an individual is going to have some type of illumination that is meaningful, useful, practical, serviceable. I've never yet seen a case where this was fulfilled. It continues to drift and drag. The individual very often gives up that which is reasonable and practical in a strange search for that which can never and has never been earned or properly deserved. I believe in the law of cause and effect. The individual who wishes to become a powerful, constructive factor in society has to cause this through the development and improvement of his own nature. It cannot be conferred upon him by some mysterious force or power which he does not even understand. He is not going to get answers that are important to questions which he does not understand. We have so many times people come and say, I have these symbolisms, I feel that they are very important, but what do they mean? It is almost impossible to answer this question for the reason that these symbols go back into the life of a person. These symbols do not descend from some level of cosmic alphabet. They come from the life of that person. They are bound directly to the background of perhaps a half century of individual living. with its reverses, with its frustrations, and with its insecurities. Now we are having a very serious situation developing in the world, and that situation deals with the actual future of humanity under the pressure of a nuclear armament. The problem of the future of humanity is to most people very serious and very disturbing. So in this particular instance, this type of thing, there is a desperate searching for some kind of assurance, some type of reality, or at least some way by which this present trend can be averted. Those who are unable to feel any particular solutional power or do not know what actually must be done have a great desire to try to understand themselves better. They want to know what happens to the human being if the worst happens in the material world. What is going to happen to a person here who suddenly is cast into another dimension of existence by nuclear warfare? Where is he going? Is he going to survive? Does he exist? What is the future of the individual who is faced with some form of physical annihilation? This question, of course, has been asked from not only from the standpoint of war, but from the standpoint of daily existence. Everyone who comes into this world is faced with the problem of leaving it. And to leave the world is a serious issue if the person is lacking in internal strength. If he is lacking in philosophic understanding, if he is lacking in religious faith, if he is lacking in deep integrities concerning the divine plan of things, if all these are immaturely developed within himself, he is in a panic. He does not know what to do. He does not know how to face into problems. Therefore, his first thought would be to try to demonstrate survival after death. And what the nature of this survival is takes him into the field of psychic phenomena. Another person with a little different sort of background, looking back over life, realizes that from lack of understanding, he has been limited all his life, that most of the plans and dreams and hopes and aspirations that were important to him were never fulfilled because of weaknesses of his own character. Under such conditions, as he grows older, he is apt to decide the importance of some form of religious communion. Young people today are not inclined to be theologically minded, but older people are consistently concerned with the future of their own existence. To have this securely indicated for them means that they must have a solid foundation in some religious or philosophical system. Actually, all of this type of thinking is founded in a certain kind of faith. The individual has to believe, and in believing has to find his security from belief, from the integrity of his own consciousness. Under such circumstances, he is apt to go to other people to try to find out more about these things. And there are groups all over the country and all over the world who are attempting in one way or another to create confidence that the individual has a survival factor built into his nature, that he is bound to survive, that he is going to go on to other worlds and other dimensions of life. If he believes in reincarnation, he believes that he will be re-embodied here in the due course of time, that basically he is indestructible. And if he is indestructible, then through philosophy and insight, he can gain a great deal of confidence. Now, systems that teach people to accept the power and virtue of universal law and can help the individual to realize that the power that fashioned him did not fashion him to destroy him. but rather fashioned him as part of a vast plan of unfolding life in nature. On a level of philosophy, individuals can gain a great deal of comfort. They can also gain it on the level of religion, in which it seems to millions of people that their future is in the keeping of a principle of divine good, and that all things that happen in this world are part of a plan for the final salvation and perfection of all that lives. With these kind of inducements, the individual can gradually develop a working philosophy of life. But very often, this is complicated today by the introduction of a whole group of extraneous elements, which may or may not contribute to this major purpose. There are a great many people who honestly believe, apparently, that while there is a divine plan, it is possible for the individual to change that plan without actually improving himself. That there are ways, there are tricks, there's a magic, there is some kind of a strange esoteric method by which the individual can become wise without earning wisdom, can become good by a formula, can be enlightened or strengthened by some type of sentimental or platitudinous statement. This actually works against the person, because he goes on with these statements, he applies them to every aspect of his life, and in the end, he is in the same condition as everyone else. These things do not change the course of his actual career. The only way that the person can get out of a weakness is to become strong. And there's no way to become strong except to earn it. The individual who wishes to be better than he is must live better than he does now. And there is no possibility of some kind of a magical intercession by which he can keep his vices and perfect his virtues at the same time. He simply cannot do it. And to most people, the present trend in the psychic phenomena is to use it as a substitute for integrity, or to assume that by the practice of certain disciplines, the individual can outgrow his own ignorance and become vicariously wise. We have very little evidence that this has ever been accomplished. And I think the average person should not bear too much upon this, because it is not strong enough to support him. I know people today who not only are seeking help from various psychic sources, but some of them have 4, 5, or 6 sources at the same time. They are going to everybody whom they think can give them an answer to their problem. The answers they get are in conflict, one in one direction, one in another. The prophecies that are made by these under these circumstances are frequently not fulfilled. And the individual, having not received what he believes he was going to receive, still goes on hoping, doing the same thing again and again. This is really a detriment. A sincere desire, even though there may be certain weaknesses or mistakes in it, has much to recommend it. But a person who simply does not recognize when things are not right keeps on stubbornly maintaining something that will not happen. This type of thing is difficult and not good for the average person. Now, all kinds of various specialties have developed in this field. Some of them go way back, thousands of years. Others are more recent in their ingenuities. But all of them seemingly have approximately the same basic elements. Man has always hoped for the miracle. He has always believed in a kind of magic. And it is very possible to convince him that by some mysterious means he can gain mastery over other people, dominate the community in which he lives, and perhaps most of all, accumulate wealth without earning it. These are very charming and fascinating possibilities. But unfortunately, in most instances, they do not work out. Books are published now every day on points and with emphasis upon sheer materialism. Not long ago, in fact, quite recently, there's a book been published on the legal aspects of cults and religions. And this book is more or less dominated or inspired by the complications on a legal level of individuals who are disillusioned, disappointed, and exploited in religious matters. How far can government, law, or litigation be involved in cases where individuals' religious convictions have been exploited? This is a grave situation. But it is obvious that the matter is getting to a point where some form of secular intervention is almost inevitable. There is going to be some form of legal recourse for persons who have been exploited in the name of religion. This does not mean that any sincere belief is going to be criticized. It does not mean that the individual is going to be denied the full expression of his faith or his inalienable right to seek spiritual consolation according to his own preferences and desires. It is, however, something that has to be faced in connection with the individual who, having supported or contributed to one of these movements, is suddenly exploited beyond a reasonable degree, or that the funds raised for religious purposes are directed to personal gain. Where this condition exists, there's going to be a great increase in care and thought, and there are going to be legal changes in the statutes which will protect the individual from dishonesty in the name of religion. Now, this does not affect most of us for the reason that the average individual is not really worried about that, except in certain cases where it should be obvious to him in the first place. But what is really the problem is how the person is going to evaluate his own inner experience with religion. How is he going to evaluate what has happened to himself on a religious level? Well, the only answer to this is to settle down quietly and do some serious thinking. And in most cases, people in trouble in this field will not do this. They are not willing to sit down and see their own mistakes. They are not willing to admit that they have been hoodwinked or that they have deceived themselves. They want to keep on pressing the points which they themselves have become accustomed to. I think probably that most of you have heard or read about a mirage in the desert. This is a phenomenon that is known throughout the world and in some cases is very highly specialized. The most common form of it is that in the desert, an individual will look over towards the horizon and he will see, for instance, a beautiful grove of trees or an oasis, or perhaps even a stream or a lake against the sky. As he approaches it, it fades away, and there is nothing there but the desert itself. Now, a considerable amount of man's wishful thinking is like a mirage. It seems to be something very beautiful lying ahead, or out somewhere in the desert of wilderness of waiting and frustration. But as he approaches it, it fades away, because it is an illusion and a delusion. Now, each person must evaluate his own beliefs, his own religious convictions, to find out if there are among them some delusions or illusions. Otherwise, he will be constantly seeking that which has no existence or is not available to him under any condition. So we have the person who is waiting patiently for enlightenment. He is waiting day by day for illumination. He is waiting to have some strange and mysterious being or power take over his life and bring him to perfection. This waiting goes on and on. It does not happen because actually the individual has not thought it through. He has not answered a very simple question. When people ask me, and some of them I do, how it happens that they were so fortunate as to have an illumination, that at least what they thought was an illumination, and that have come under the special control or protection of divine beings, I've often asked them, how did you happen to deserve this? What did you do to earn it? Why were you picked out of a million people to receive the deeper and inner instruction? And I've never had an answer that made sense. Most of them admitted they had no idea. That they didn't understand it themselves. They didn't know why they'd been chosen out of millions of people. So the next question is, for those people who think it has happened to them, to measure themselves and see what they might have inside that would have justified it. What had they done? What kind of lives had they lived? Did they rise above the commonplace in conduct? Were they especially honest? Were they dedicated? Were they good parents? Were they faithful marriage partners? Would they always do the thing as nobly and honorably as possible? Were they satisfied with a quiet life and moderate existence? What had they done that out of many they should be chosen? And they didn't know. And after looking them over carefully, it became evident that there was nothing visible to indicate their selection. They had no abilities. They had no understanding that was available to them. And sometimes these people went through a whole series of relationships with psychism or some metaphysical group, and they ended up where they started from because they were not taught anything that was practical to do, even when they were under instruction. It was simply a case of wishful thinking, of a great desire which was not backed by anything. So wherever you start thinking about meditation or concentration or Zen or some discipline to unfold inner consciousness, the question must always be considered as to how qualified the person is to receive such enlightenment. How is he going to use it? How is he going to get away from his own futility simply by practicing a discipline of some kind, which does not contain within it any particular solution? A good example of this, of course, is the classical case of a young American who wanted to be a Zen monk. He went to the Orient, he studied there, and he sat very quietly in the corner and was ignored year after year. He was not picked up as a wonderful prime candidate and given all kinds of attention. And he remained quietly in the shadow of the temple for 10 years before one of the masters of the temple came and began to give him a little instruction. He had to prove himself. He had to prove that nothing could turn him away. He had to prove that there were no personal ambitions in himself. He had to prove that he was not out to be rich or powerful or dominate other people. He had to simply dedicate himself in a simple, direct way to whatever the rules were of the group to which he belonged. He wisely chose a group that had a wonderful background and was highly respected and revered for nearly 1,000 years. He was therefore reasonably certain that he was on the right track. All this type of thing finally sums up, I think, into the problems of the person's life. The beginning of life, in the lesser mysteries, as they were called in Greece and Egypt and India, the lesser mysteries are right here. the beginning of esotericism is in your home, your shop, and your business, and your relation with your children and friends. The beginning of philosophy is the daily use of common sense. Those who hope or aspire to enlightenment are the ones who live within their means, who do not cultivate debt, who refrain from unnecessary extravagances, and do not fall under those luxury pressures which contribute to moral or physical dishonesty. The individual begins here by putting his life in order. He also takes advantage, as far as possible, of the opportunities here for anything that he wishes to do. The ancients, when they brought some candidate to the temple, always required that this candidate bring with him an offering worthy of the temple. This was not an offering of money, because in ancient times, most of the religious systems were subsidized by the state. What he was expected to bring was an ability. He was expected to have a proficiency that was useful, a proficiency which assisted him to be a better servant of human need, something that would help others, something that he could use because he was trained in it and would therefore have a proper ability to use it wisely. Perhaps he was trained in medicine. He had taken a course in the temples of the god of healing. After he had graduated from that, he dedicated his medical knowledge to the service of humanity. And it was not until medicine was secularized that there was any known corruption in the medical world. Another might take law and become a leader of governments. One might become an instructor of children. Still another might become an artist or a musician. Or perhaps intentionally and purposefully become an agriculturist and raise food for others to eat. He must have some dedication to the service of humanity. A dedication which was not only willingness, but skill. He must be able to do this type of thing. If he was to become a teacher, he must have had the background for it. It was only the ability that he possessed that he could dedicate to God. His ignorance was of no value to himself or the universe. His wisdom was valuable to all who needed it. So the problem was to start here. Curb appetites, normalize life, rationalize experiences, live in a natural, healthful manner. Take care of the small daily problems as they arise. For if we are faithful unto small things, we shall be made master over greater things.